Think back to when you were a kid. Do you remember the lunch lady at your school? It seems these school cafeteria food service directors were overwhelmingly female, in my recollection at least. We're going to talk about the complexity of running a school cafeteria this hour, trying to make nutritious meals under the pressure of ultra-lean budgets and strict food guidelines from the USDA. Our next guest walked in the footsteps of a food service director in West Virginia to uncover the challenges and stresses of her job. Joining us now is Jane Black. She's a food writer covering food politics and sustainability issues. Her recent feature titled Revenge of the Lunch Lady was a joint project of the Huffington Post Highline and the Food and Environment Reporting Network, an independent news organization. Jane, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
For this project, you spent a lot of time in Huntington, West Virginia, which had the distinction of being an extremely unhealthy place to live. And you spent a lot of time with Rhonda McCoy. Who is she?
Rhonda McCoy is the food service director for Cabell County, which is one of 55 counties in West Virginia. When you say a long time, it was indeed a long time. It was 6 years. My husband and I actually moved to Huntington for 6 months in 2010 because, as some of your listeners may remember, there was a reality TV show called Food Revolution, which is when a celebrity chef from England, Jamie Oliver, came and he was going to save this town, which had been named the most unhealthy city in America. The people in the town dispute that, but that's a separate story. And, you know, he came into the schools and said, oh, look at this junk they're eating. And, you know, they're eating pizza for breakfast and what a disgrace. And Rhonda McCoy is, and I say this with a great amount of love for her, is the absolute worst person you could put on a reality TV show. She is not into gossiping and drama. She is not somebody who, she's an extreme introvert, I would say. And, you know, she was sort of thrust into the spotlight. And so he came and he went. And then it was left to her to sort of clean up the mess. And over the last 6 years, she has done some truly amazing work. I have been covering school lunch for many, many years and the crazy politics that are associated with it. And she has, in 6 years, essentially transformed the program so that, you know, some 80 to 90% of the food is cooked from scratch. It meets all of the guidelines. They have students growing food for the salad bar that is served in the cafeteria. And they're serving more children than ever. So it's a really remarkable story.
And through your piece, Rhonda taught me a whole lot about the complexity of feeding children and how this business of running a cafeteria is really complicated. And at the beginning of your piece, I thought Rhonda was the enemy in serving bad food. But at the end, she was my hero. Explain how she transformed the meals in her school district.
Well, I mean, I think that it's very difficult to explain, and this piece was a bear, because you think, right, you get food and you cook it and you serve it to kids, right? It shouldn't be that complicated. But it is incredibly complicated because there are, you know, a zillion regulations that require you to do all sorts of things and a budget that gives you about, in Rhonda's case, about $1.50 for food per meal. So imagine trying to cook yourself a healthy meal that meets salt requirements and vegetable requirements and all of these things for $1.50, and you're feeding 10,000 kids a day. So, you know, she had to do a lot of different things, and we can dig in on whichever ones you think are the most interesting. But one of the things that she was very lucky about when she started was that her schools actually had kitchens. And that sounds ridiculous because you'd think, well, if you're feeding kids, you need a kitchen. But in many schools, as a result of federal policies over the last 30 years, you know, they have a microwave. And in one school that I, you know, read a case study about and included in my piece, you know, they didn't even have that. They were heating up meals for kids in the staff room microwave. Mm. So, you know, she had kitchens and she had cooks. And what she was able to do was apply for grants, state grants, federal grants, to really buy a lot of food equipment, you know, big industrial mixers and things called tilt skillets that let you cook, you know, vats of tomato sauce in one go. And she was able to spend a lot of money and get a lot of bang for her buck, because even though the tilt skillet cost $15,000, which is a lot of money, you know, it makes it possible for them to make spaghetti sauce from scratch for all their kids.
And Congress, for years, didn't provide funds to upgrade or improve school kitchen equipment. How does that play into this larger picture of what ends up on the kids' trays?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. And the history of that goes back to the 1980s. There used to be money that the federal government gave to schools to make sure that they had equipment to actually cook on. And during the Reagan years, when they decided that they were going to slash all of this domestic spending, they stopped giving money to schools. And as a result, schools, you know, had to find other ways to get food on the plates. And so they started buying, you know, processed foods, things that came into the cafeteria that were already cooked that only needed a microwave. That, of course, is the kind of food that we now gasp over and say is so terrible for our kids. But it was a direct result of this decision. I mean, among many decisions, nothing is simple in school lunch. And so they stopped giving money in the 80s, and it was not until 2009 that the federal government gave any money at all to schools for equipment. And that was part of, you know, the big stimulus package after, you know, basically it took the economy almost crashing in order for the federal government to decide, hey, maybe we should give some money to schools.
We're talking with Jane Black, a food writer covering food politics. Her recent feature titled Revenge of the Lunch Lady was a joint project of the Huffington Post Highline and the Food and Environment Reporting Network. Jane, in 2014, First Lady Michelle Obama held a roundtable with nutritionists, and she said Congress shouldn't, quote, play politics with kids' health. She was trying to head off legislation that would allow some districts to temporarily opt out of new federal mandates to increase whole grains, fresh fruits, and vegetables in school lunches. And let's listen to a bit of that speech.
Moms and dads don't want their efforts undermined when they send their kids off to school. Parents have a right to expect that their kids will get decent food in our schools. And we all have a right to expect that our hard-earned taxpayer dollars won't be spent on junk food for our kids.
Take us back. What happened to this legislation, and what was the controversy here between Democrats and Republicans?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There are so many pieces, but the nutrition, the actual what has to go on the plate, is extremely political. And Michelle Obama had sort of spearheaded new nutrition requirements that would increase the number of fruits and vegetables that were on kids' plates, as well as lowering sodium. They hadn't done this for years and years. And, of course, it became very political because, you know, the beef industry didn't want anybody saying that they should eat less meat, and the potato industry didn't want anybody eating fewer French fries. And so every single time that they looked at rebalancing the plate, if you will, a particular industry would get involved. And that's what she was referring to. In 2011, this is before the clip that you played, this is just a perfect example. One of the recommendations that they had made was to limit the amount of potatoes and starchy vegetables that were on plates. Now, this was specifically geared to French fries. Nobody was worried they were serving too many lima beans on plates, which also count as a starchy vegetable. Congress stepped in. Two Senate leaders from Maine and Colorado, which is where a lot of potatoes are grown, came in and said, you know, potatoes are a nutritional bargain and they have as much potassium as bananas. And Congress voted to make sure that French fries stayed on the cafeteria trays.
And so what kind of bind then has this put on school cafeteria and food service directors who are trying to conform with the law and what the USDA guidelines are telling them, and also make sure that they're staying within these really, really tight budgets?
Yeah, it's really hard. It's very hard for them. And I think that there are a number of levels where it's difficult. First of all, you know, you're trying to keep up with the changing rules and the science. You know, you can't just sort of have a menu that you're sending out every day. You have to change it to respond to these rules. Second of all, if you're reliant on processed foods, you know, if you don't have that kitchen, if you don't have that cook, it's very hard to quickly change your menu because you have to wait for the new products to come through, you know, the research and development from these big food companies. You know, that said, I really do think that the complaints about a lot of these new nutrition standards are perhaps a bit louder than they should be. There have been studies, I don't have the numbers directly in front of me, that, you know, some 90% of schools have been able to adjust to these nutritional regulations successfully, and that most of the kids are eating and liking the food. I think a lot of attention goes to the French fry stories because, you know, they make a good headline. The harder part is the amount of money that is available for them to provide food and for the staff that are required to make good food.
Your article always circles back to the political forces that control school lunches in America. And now under the Trump administration, it remains to be seen whether the program will be scaled back or how nutritional standards will change. There's a 2014 speech of House Speaker Paul Ryan, who equated public assistance in school lunches to an empty soul. And I want to take a listen to this clip for a moment.
The left is making a big mistake here. What they're offering people is a full stomach and an empty soul. The American people want more than that. You know, this reminds me of a story I heard from Eloise Anderson. She serves in the cabinet of my buddy, Governor Scott Walker. She once met a young boy from a very poor family. And every day at school, he would get a free lunch from a government program. He told Eloise he didn't want a free lunch. He wanted his own lunch, one in a brown paper bag, just like the other kids. He wanted one, he said, because he knew a kid with a brown paper bag had someone who cared for him.
Well, let's unpack this for a moment. And besides, there was the controversy around this speech because actually this kid was from a commercial and didn't exist how it was in the speech. But explain the argument that Paul Ryan is making here and how school lunches, a $12 billion government program, is caught up in politics.
Right. I mean, I think that's exactly right. I mean, and the fact that, as you said, that kid wasn't actually making that point shows how politicized this is. But the point that he was making and the point that the Republicans make quite often is that, you know, these school programs, you know, are like any other kind of welfare, and that, you know, it takes away from that pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you know, American way. The problem with that argument, in my mind, is that there are a number of problems with that argument. So I'm just trying to sort of organize them for you. But the issue is that they think no one should get a free lunch, right? But there are a lot of people in this country who rely on school to get their meals. There are hungry kids in this country, and I think that when they argue that it is perverse that somebody would get a free meal that they don't deserve or someone would get subsidized, they misunderstand what are essentially the way that school lunch operates. If you're only going to give a very small amount of money for each kid, the more kids you're feeding, the easier it is to feed them. So you have to kind of think about it like for yourself, if you can bear with my math. If you're buying food for four people and you're spending $20, but then you invite two more people, it's probably only another $5 because you're buying a couple more potatoes and a little more salad. It doesn't cost another 50%. So the problem is what people are arguing is, you know, let's feed as many kids as we can because that makes it more efficient. We get more bang for our buck, whereas the Republicans seem very stuck on the idea that if you earn more than a certain amount of money every year, God forbid that you would get a free hamburger and French fries. And so, you know, it becomes a question. The school lunch lady is like Rhonda, want to argue the practical mathematical thing, not the political philosophical thing. But school lunch keeps getting, you know, sucked into these, you know, philosophical debates about, you know, what the American government should be providing to its citizens.
We're talking with Jane Black. She covers food politics and was a Washington Post staff writer. Her recent long-form article is Revenge of the Lunch Lady. It's a joint project of the Huffington Post Highline and the nonprofit Food and Environment Reporting Network. And we have a link, by the way, on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. You can join in the school lunch discussion here at 800-642-1234. Are there unique things happening in your school district that are bringing about healthier options? What needs fixing about food in America's schools? Join in at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. David in Madison emails, can you talk about the challenge for schools and parents who wish there was a school lunch option when it comes to kids with special diets, such as vegan, kosher, or kids who have allergies? He says it seems impossible for schools to serve those diets. When his son was in kindergarten, the lunch lady laughed when he asked her about a vegetarian choice. He says, needless to say, he has taken a bagged lunch ever since. Jane, yeah, what would you say to that?
Gosh, I have a lot of sympathy for, you know, for that parent and for that child. And, you know, you should certainly never laugh at a kid who's asking for a specific kind of food that we should be able to accommodate. The trick is that, as I said, it's very hard to respond to specific diets when you only have a certain amount of food and you have to mass produce. The other problem is that the nutrition standards require that, you know, everybody get X amount of protein and X amount of starch and X amount of this and that. And if you start saying, well, you can have this and not that, then the school doesn't get reimbursed for the meal because they haven't provided the adequate nutrition. So it seems crazy, but that's the way it operates. And so I think that that is a problem, but not one that is likely to be addressed anytime soon, given the system that we have.
Let's go to a call now. Greg from Racine. Hi, Greg.
Thank you for taking my call. My wife, I shouldn't have said that, actually, but cat's out of the bag. My wife is a music teacher in the Racine Unified School District. And so I'm not sure if this is a local policy or a state policy or maybe nationally mandated through the legislation we've been talking about. And I'm very sympathetic about that and enthusiastic about it in general. But there is very, very strict regulation now on what, for instance, she is permitted to bring to school as treats for the students who assist her in the classroom or the students that sing in the concerts at night and so on. Once upon a time, she was rather free to bring just about anything she wanted, and now all kinds of things are absolutely forbidden. And again, while I, in general, are very sympathetic, in complete agreement with much of what this legislation suggests, I do personally feel like it goes a little too far in if indeed this legislation is responsible for these restrictions being so tight that you can't bring a donut or you can't bring a lollipop or whatever. I'm just curious if your guest would have any opinion about that. I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you.
Well, it's a great question, and it is another political controversy that is oft talked about. For once, it is not school lunch's fault. The National School Lunch Program has nothing to do with what is served or what is allowed to be brought into the classroom. It is only what is served on the tray or, for example, if you have breakfast in your classroom. So those are local policies. As far as I know, there may be, you know, some may be controlled by the state, some may be controlled by the district, but that is actually not part of this. And it is something that people get enraged about. I mean, in 2010, I remember Sarah Palin showed up at a school in Pennsylvania with a tray full of cookies to make the point that, you know, schools should not be deciding what kids can eat on their birthday.
Thank you so much for your call. And I want to ask you, Jane, has the original purpose and the original intention of the National School Lunch Program evolved or changed? And what are the new needs that are rising that may have been very minor in the past?
Well, that's a wonderful question. I mean, it certainly has changed over time. You know, the program was set up, it had a conflict of interest at the heart of the program from the very beginning. It was set up right after World War II, and it was motivated by requests from military leaders who wanted to make sure that there were healthy kids to fight in whatever the next war was, and by farmers who were looking for a place to dump surpluses. And so kids sort of got caught in the middle of that. You know, their nutrition was important, but so was getting rid of whatever the farmers had extras of. Over time, you know, the issue has become less about whether kids are getting enough calories to fight in those wars or whether they're getting too many or too many of the wrong kinds. And so that's why we've had a lot of these debates about nutrition and what should be on the tray. I mean, there used to be rules that said that you couldn't have fewer than a certain number of calories because the idea was to get as many calories into these kids as possible. But now I think for me, the focus is really on, you know, helping, the important focus should be on helping children who are hungry. And to come back to Rhonda, I mean, I think that is really what drives her. I think it's very hard for many people in this country to believe that there are kids that are hungry. We need to focus on policies that make sure that the schools in those districts have the money and resources they need to feed kids so that they can focus and learn while they're in school.
And you end your story, it's pretty, a very downtrodden Rhonda McCoy. She faces the uncertainty of what will happen to her budget under the Trump administration. Her fear is that some of her kids will go hungry, and her supportive superintendent is retiring. What should we make of the ending of your story?
Well, I was trying to be hopeful. I think that it's just that school lunch, even a very successful system, even someone who has someone like Rhonda McCoy, who is smart and dedicated and works really hard, that the system is incredibly precarious because you're at the mercy of your local school district, of the state budget, of the federal budgets, of a politician who has an axe to grind about welfare, of, you know, somebody of the potato industry who wants to make sure it sells potatoes. I mean, these, as you said, mostly women, you know, are really doing their best in the, you know, and being caught in all of these different sort of political games. So, you know, what I always say to people, and it's a sort of a big thought, and is that, you know, we as a country need to decide how and if we want to feed our children and what is our value around that so that it stops being a political football and starts being something that this is what we agree on and then we go do it and we make those women's jobs easier because they have a directive that they can follow.
Jane, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Jane Black is a freelance food writer and has spent months, years reporting on the challenges of the National School Lunch Program, walking in the footsteps of a school food service director in Huntington, West Virginia. Her reporting on the complicated issues surrounding school lunches was made possible through the Food and Environment Reporting Network. Her long-form piece, Revenge of the Lunch Lady, was published last month in the Huffington Post. We have a link to it on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. I'm Kate Archer Kent in for Kathleen Dunn. After a short break, we'll be joined by the CEO of Sustainable Kitchens, a Wauwatosa-based consulting firm that works with school districts to create healthier recipes and menu items. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're continuing our conversation about the National School Lunch Program and the challenges schools face in feeding kids. We're going to focus on the rest of this hour on Wisconsin school districts and school lunches. Joining us now is Chef Justin Johnson. He studied at Cordon Bleu Chicago and the Culinary Institute of America. He founded Sustainable Kitchens, a Milwaukee-based company that works with clients like school districts and hospitals, nursing homes, to introduce more scratch cooking and to cut down on processed foods. Justin, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Before we get to your work with schools, I want to ask you, what was your experience like with school lunches when you were growing up? What are your memories?
Oh, my goodness. I remember a personal favorite of mine was a pizza pocket that was kind of, I guess, sort of like a hot pocket. And it was this delicious, crispy, sort of flaky crust with, I don't know, some sort of nightmare filling, some meat, sauce, sugar, salty, something. I don't know, but I used to eat it every day. That was kind of, it's funny that you asked that, because one of the things that we talk about all the time with our school programs is that so many kids, just like a lot of adults, have routines. You know, when they go in to the lunch room for the first lunch or the first school day of the year, they kind of get in a line, and that tends to be their line the whole rest of the year. You know, they eat the same thing, and don't really change that very much. So when you start to introduce new food, it can be a little bit challenging to get them interested and engaged.
Breaking habits, yeah. Yep. So where does your company come in, Sustainable Kitchens?
Okay, so we, primarily we work with, I shouldn't say primarily. We work with, all segments of food service. But, our system is really kind of tailored toward institutional food service, or what we call non-commercial food service. In other words, not hotels or restaurants. However, we do have restaurant clients. And what a school will sort of engage us for is to help develop menus and recipes that can be operationalized in their facilities, and then do the culinary training that goes along with it. And a lot of times that also ropes in all sorts of other kind of policy and procedure types of things and operational systems, because if a kitchen isn't set up to cook from scratch, it can be sort of difficult to figure out how to do that if a staff isn't used to working with raw proteins. We have to, sort of do some food safety and sanitation training and how to receive raw protein and store it and all of that.
So tell us what you do when you first step foot in a school cafeteria kitchen. What are you looking for? What are you asking about? Where do you start?
Well, the question that we always ask is, what is the program not doing that you want it to do? Because, in any kind of food service, it's easy to say we want to give the kids healthier food, but it has to be food that they're actually going to eat, because particularly in a high school, if they have an open campus, and even when they don't, if they have the option to bring food from the outside, they'll do that. And one of the biggest measurements for success of a school food service program is participation. They don't, with a restaurant, they're always looking at cost and revenue. In a hospital, they're looking at their survey scores. But in a school, it's all about how many kids are coming to the lunchroom and selecting
sheer volume.
The lunch that's on offer. So we have to figure out exactly what the kids want. And so we go through a process. It sounds sort of odd, but we go through a process of establishing a brand for the cafeteria, much the way you would if you were going to be opening a restaurant. And it's not for the purpose of, creating a design or a name or a logo or a catchphrase. It's for the purpose of understanding what the identity of that cafeteria is and what those kids want in that part of the world or in that town or that city, and what they're going to kind of respond to and what they're going to be excited about. And the other thing, too, that I have to say is that school food is an oxymoron in and of itself. There's no reason to think that food in school would be good, because everything about the way it's set up kind of works against that. When you have, like your previous guest was talking about, so many schools don't even have kitchens, really. Not in the way that we think of a kitchen in a restaurant that is able to make, a lot of food. Then the other thing is that, you have all of the USDA guidelines and the NSLP guidelines. And then you have a staff of people that aren't culinary trained, and more importantly than that, a lot of times they're part-timers. So they don't, it's not really like a full-time job for them. They come in with just enough time to kind of get everything set up and get the food out, serve it, and break down and go home. So it's not like a traditional sort of job in that regard. So to create delicious, wonderful, beautiful food in that environment is really challenging. So what we've done to get around that, or to kind of embrace that challenge, is we try to cross-utilize as many low-cost, simple ingredients as we can, like tomato paste, you know, onions, carrots, things that aren't fancy, things that aren't expensive, and things that the schools, you know, have really get really good pricing on. And we take those things and we create as many dishes around that as possible. It's kind of one of the fundamental tenets of our system, that instead of writing a menu or writing a recipe and then going out and trying to find where the ingredients are, what we do is we find the ingredients first. And we say, okay, let's say we can only get these 20 things or these 30 things, and put all those things up on a whiteboard or, you know, on a, you know, create a list, and then look at them and say, okay, how many dishes can we make with just that? And that's kind of where we start. And we try to make sure that the actual preparation of the food is relatively simple, and kind of requires as few steps as possible, because the other real challenge is service time. A lot of school lunch windows are
really, really short.
Really short.
Yeah.
They herd the kids through, and they only have a few minutes to eat. And you know, it's amazing. You know, when we see kitchens serve, you know, like 600 kids in 15 minutes, it's crazy. And to think that, like, you're going to be able to put together this, like, beautiful restaurant quality dish, it just isn't going to happen.
It's not going to happen.
Really have as few steps and as few moves to get the food delivered as possible.
We're talking with Justin Johnson. He's CEO of Sustainable Kitchens in Milwaukee. We're looking at the challenges that school districts face in their school lunch programs. 30 million students rely on the National School Lunch Program every day for lunch. You can add your voice to the conversation at 800-642-1234. How do you think school lunches could be improved? What do you think about what your children say to you about their school lunches? Join in 800-642-1234 or post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Let's take a call now. Mary from Greenfield. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I just had a couple of questions. My husband and I actually own a computer software company in West Dallas. We custom design software for primarily nursing homes, and have always been interested in getting involved in school lunches. I was listening to your previous speaker, who was saying something about that a lot of the schools don't have kitchens that they can actually prepare food. But when you go and visit the school and you see the amount of the obese children that really survive on packaged foods and, you know, are really in a position of having health issues, why is the state of Wisconsin, or even generally the nation, why aren't they taking advantage of more food programs? I mean, basically, what we see is nursing homes right now, their biggest costs are labor and food. In general, we can feed a resident with our program for about $6 a day, and that is quality food. So my question is, why is it so difficult for the schools to provide more nutritionally balanced, healthier food when you buy food in bulk and it's so much cheaper?
Justin?
Yeah, well, first of all, The reason that it's so hard for schools to do that is because it's not their business. It's not what they exist to do. It's an amenity. Food is an amenity that schools are forced to provide because they have kids captive for, you know, over a meal period. And so the least amount of resources and facilities are put into food as possible. It's not good, it's not right, but that's what I meant before when I said school food is an oxymoron, because the two things don't go together. And what we're trying to do is really show that a simple, good, delicious meal is executable in a short amount of time, and that it's scalable, and that it can be done for a lot of kids in a short amount of time. And, you know, to be perfectly honest, I am I'm sort of new to this world. I started my company 2 years ago, and we've worked a lot with senior homes and hospitals and so forth, and we've just kind of started to venture into the school food realm, and it's been really fascinating, really interesting. And, you know, I always, you know, we sort of look at school food programs, or, you know, any food program, and say it's really just people in a room making food for people in another room. What's so hard? But when you actually get into a school and you see what they're dealing with, to get good food on the plate in a short amount of time for a lot of kids, with all of the barriers that are in place, is incredibly hard. So I don't think it's necessarily that schools don't recognize that they need to serve better food or don't want to serve better food. I think they want to, they want to be able to do as much as they can, but because it is not the focus of why they exist, their focus is to educate kids, food just kind of falls into the background.
Mary, thanks so much for your call. Let's now go to Lydia in Duluth. Hi, Lydia.
Hi. I had a question about, I have a child, a first grader, and I don't know if it's a state or federal, but when you look at what's considered a vegetable or a fruit, about those guidelines of what they have to serve to kids, and I know in my district at least, pizza is considered a vegetable because it has the tomato sauce, but the sauce has a lot of salt. And I mean, when you look at the nutritional content of what they're considering a vegetable, I mean, you know, what are these kids actually getting? Oh, they're getting a serving of vegetables, but is it really healthy for them?
Well, the thing I'll say too about the National School Lunch Program, those guidelines, a lot of food service directors, they sort of balk at that, and they've been able to get away with finding loopholes, like how pizza is a vegetable. But that's not what our system does. For us, vegetables are vegetables, and meat is meat, and fruit is fruit. And so when we have to, you know, have a half a cup of vegetables and a half a cup of fruit per plate, it's real food. It's real vegetables. And I like the NSLP guidelines. The problem is that a lot of food service directors just haven't interpreted them as they were intended. And it's not so much the fault of the guidelines as it is the fault of the food service director saying, what can I get away with?
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Lydia, for your call. We're talking with Justin Johnson, CEO of Sustainable Kitchens, looking at school cafeterias, food service, and how schools can serve up healthier lunches, especially under federal food subsidies that are very tricky for many school districts. You can join in the discussion now at 800-642-1234. How do you think school lunches could be improved? What are your questions about how school lunches are put together? Join in at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent in for Kathleen Dunn. We'll be back after a short break here on the Ideas Network. for picking up our conversation with Chef Justin Johnson about school lunches in America and nutritional breakthroughs at some school cafeterias. Justin founded his consulting firm Sustainable Kitchens in 2015, working with clients like school districts to incorporate more scratch cooking and reduce the amount of processed food. And you can join in the discussion at 800-642-1234 or post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Let's now go to Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I went through the school lunch program, and I've been in Wisconsin more than 64 years. But the discussion came up. I have grandkids who went to school in Georgia, and then they recently had to come back to Wisconsin, and they won't eat the food here anymore because after living in Georgia, they were immensely surprised that the food they got was so good. They wanted to go to school just to eat the lunch there, and the cost is about the same. I want to know how is it that the food there can be provided for the same costs, the same issues with issuing food to kids in a certain length of time and on sometimes on a small budget. They went to public school there. And I went to public school here in Wisconsin. I can remember many, many years ago when I went to school, the food was better. Things have gotten actually worse, but we have more money and more technology now. So why is that?
That's tough to say. I would need to, I guess, see what food we're actually talking about on some of those Georgia lunch menus. But really, it's just about what I was saying before about the limitations and the facilities and resources that are allocated to school lunch programs. It comes down to the people in the room and what they have to work with. And I'm certainly not saying that a lot of what is served is excusable, or that there's certainly schools and I'm sure directors that have not put a lot of effort into making the food as good as it can be, but that's really not the fault of the National School Lunch Program. That has to be looked at on a school by school basis, because the National School Lunch Program is really just a list of guidelines. They don't tell you what to put on your menus or what to serve necessarily or how to get it done. And that was one of the things that I've always felt about the National School Lunch Program, that it was sort of like step two of a two-step process, and they skipped over step one. Step one being providing some sort of guidance, some sort of culinary direction and a template and a system for how to actually make good food and how to cook vegetables properly and how to handle raw meat. They just sort of gave the guidelines and said, well, this is what has to be on the plate. And then you had all of these food service workers and food service directors saying, "Oh, okay, well, we don't know how to do any of that." So, voila, pizza is a vegetable. So, it has to be looked at on a case by case, school by school, director by director thing.
Yeah. Thanks so much for your call. Let's, Justin. If schools could make one easy, painless, positive step in their cafeterias, what would you suggest?
Ooh, easy and painless. Those words do not apply when it comes to school lunch. I think probably the easiest thing and the cheapest thing, certainly, would be simply to extend the meal period. That's probably one of the biggest issues and challenges that these programs face, is that there just isn't enough time to get a good product out, and frankly, there isn't enough time for the kids to really enjoy or appreciate the food. If we had longer meal program or meal periods, and rather than hurtling everybody through all at once, kind of breaking those periods up a little bit and allowing them to have the time to really see what's being served and select it and enjoy it. I think that would be a huge benefit.
Let's go to Billy now in Monona. Hi, Billy.
Hi. Hi. When I was a kid, the school lunch program, the food was higher quality, but it was very limited. But they served like one entree. Like today we'd have chicken, a vegetable, some fruit, and some bread. And maybe tomorrow, maybe it'd be hamburgers and french fries or something like that. But it would be, you wouldn't have all the selection. But what I notice now with my kids, that there's more selection, but less quality. And I think, I always thought, go back, simplify it. Serve a good meal, but this is what you get. This is what we're having today. And it's just an idea. And that's what I noticed when I was growing up.
Justin, stripping down the offerings.
I totally agree with that. I think that is definitely the way to go. And it's, one of the first things that we always look at with a program is, do we need all these options? Do we need a 6-week cycle? Can we do a 3-week cycle and have fewer offerings? Less is more. Let's try to do fewer things and do them better. And in reference to, how the food, this is the second time now that we had somebody mention that the food when they were going to school was better than it is now. That's a food industry thing. That's a food system problem. Because I always tell the story about when I started working at a hospital in Watertown. I gathered up the cooks and the servers and, my first couple of weeks, and I said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to get rid of all the processed food, and we're going to cook everything from scratch, and we're going to grow food on site. And, the people that had been there for, 10, 20 years or so, they were up in arms and they said, oh, that's impossible. You can't make us do that. And the people that had been there for 30 years or more, they said, oh, yeah, like we used to.
Yeah. Well, Billy, thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Leela Quick in Milwaukee. We're running short on time, Leela. What would you like to add?
Sure. So real quickly, I just wanted to make a comment about how back when I was a kid, all of the kitchens at all the individual schools used to make the food from scratch. And now we have two central locations that make all of the food, and then it's shipped, everything's individually wrapped to all these other schools. And being a nutritionist, I see, we've got pretty bland color wheel. Everything is either brown and white. There's, not a lot of color. And then there's the waste from everything being individually wrapped.
Right, and that's, again, just goes back to, the fact that having the food made at a central location enables them to have a smaller workforce and not have to actually build kitchens in the schools or have, like, real kitchens or anything more than a microwave or a hot plate available to prepare the food, and then not having to staff the people to work at all of those schools. I mean, when you have a centralized kind of kitchen, it's a good thing in some ways when you can, do bulk things like your breads and your sauces and roasting whole meats and things like that. But then if we can get, the central kitchens to ship out all of those components so that on the actual site in the school kitchen itself, they just bring the meal together and they, they assemble in the school as opposed to, like the caller said, assembling everything at the central kitchen and packaging it up and shipping it out and, it going through all that kind of time and temperature abuse. And by the time it is actually in front of the person eating it, it's a shadow of what it was.
Yeah, it must make your job a bit harder too if these kitchens that schools you're trying to work with don't have a complete kitchen.
Yeah, and actually one of our districts that is very much the case where the recipes have to be prepared at a central location, and we sort of developed a formula for how we bring together the vegetables, the sauce, and the protein kind of in components and parts. and then, you know, heating it up in large pans and sending that out so that everything isn't, you know, cooked so far in advance.
In advance, yeah.
And,
Justin,
you know, being held.
I have to cut you off here. Thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Justin Johnson is CEO of Sustainable Kitchens, a Milwaukee-based consulting firm working with clients like school districts to incorporate more scratch cooking. We can continue this conversation about school lunches over on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Thanks to Natalie Guyette for producing this hour with on-air production help from Cheryl Gasser and technical direction from Dave Potraz. I'm Kate Archer-Kent in for Kathleen Dunn, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.